Good evening, and welcome to the Cook & Bynum Conversation with the Mutual Fund Observer. All participants will be in a listen-only mode. Should you need assistance, please signal a conference specialist by pressing the star key followed by zero. After today's presentation, there will be an opportunity to ask questions. Please note this event is being recorded, and I would now like to turn the conference over to David Snowball. Please go ahead.
Thank you, Emily. And good evening, everyone. Welcome to the Mutual Fund Observers chat with Richard Cook and Al Bynum, managers of the Cook & Bynum Fund. The Observer is an independent, non-commercial service whose special focus is new and smaller funds, Seafarer, River Park, Aston River Road, and others, whose merits far outweigh the attention that they've received. This is one in a series of calls with high-conviction managers. It's designed, first, to allow our readers to hear a manager's reflection on the fund's genesis, and second, to give you the rare opportunity to speak directly with the folks who you might entrust with your hard-earned money. Our plan for this hour is to devote the first third of the hour to an introduction to the fund, the middle third to my chat with Richard and Dow, and the final third to your questions. We'll explain the mechanics for asking questions as the time draws near. For now, just keep track of them and know your time is coming. The changing imperatives of the fund industry have led many managers to become mediocre by design. Their response is driven by the anxious desire for so-called sticky assets, and their strategy is simple. If you make your fund very much like its benchmark, you're never going to disastrously trail the benchmark, and if you never trail all that dramatically, you're not going to lose the money that was entrusted to you by legions of retirement savers. The fact that you never excel becomes, for them, irrelevant. The result is a legion of large, expensive, undistinguished funds who seek safety in the herd. If you look at simple measures, Morningstar records 54 one-star funds that have at least $1 billion in assets. The Observer's Roll Call of the Wretched, which tracks funds that have trailed their peers for the last 1, 3, 5, 10, and 15-year periods, shows that there are 99 funds with over $1 billion in assets that have been consistently mediocre or worse. The Cook & Bynum Fund strikes me as the antithesis of those, carefully constructed, tightly focused, and intentionally distinct. We're joined tonight by David Hobbs, president of Cook & Bynum. David has agreed to open our conversation by introducing the guys and their firm. Dave, welcome.
Thank you, David, and thank you for this opportunity to speak to this community. And we're very grateful for all the efforts that you make to make the site go and to make this call happen. And thank you to all the callers that are on tonight. We appreciate, again, the opportunity to share a little bit about what we do. I'm going to be very, very brief and just give you a little bit of background on Cook & Bynum Capital Management. We were founded in 2001 by Richard and Dow, and they'll talk a little bit more about how they came to form the company and how they met originally. But we're now about $250 million in assets. We invest through private partnerships and the mutual fund, which has recently passed $100 million in assets. And we use the same global concentrated value style across all the vehicles. So we're really just trying to do this one thing well, and that's sort of our approach to the world. Richard and Dow, we'll jump in here now, but they're going to talk about three things. One, as I mentioned, the genesis of the firm, how we got started, and again, how they met, our overall philosophy and our core investment criteria, and how we sort of try to apply those things in a very disciplined way, and then how we build and how we think about our portfolio of global stocks.
Thank you, David. This is Richard. And I guess to understand Cook & Bynum, you have to sort of understand our Dow's and I's relationship. We grew up in preschool through high school together and have been working on various things together all along that way. And we've had a mutual interest in stock markets and in business going back to elementary school. But in high school, we got a hold of originally Lowenstein's biography of Buffett, and then immediately we followed that with The Intelligent Investor Security Analysis by Ben Graham and on from there. And I've heard Mr. Buffett describe that value investing as being an inoculation like St. Paul on the road to Damascus. And that is certainly how it was for us. It seemed obvious immediately that this was the right way to do it. And so we, since that time in high school, we've tried to figure out a way to both work together, but also to do this particular type of investing in what we, you know, might call a pure way, or a way that's where we think of our mandate as what is the best way to both protect your capital and earn the highest return on it over a 30-year period of time? And how would we do that with all of our own money and then design a fund that goes along for the ride? And so that's what we've attempted to do here with our mandate and what we've been attempting to build as a firm for 11 and a half years. I worked at, after high school, I went to work for Tudor Investment in Connecticut, which is a large macro hedge fund, which is as far away from value investing as you could get, I suppose. But I went there knowing I wanted to be a value investor, and I learned a tremendous amount of market history and sort of the whole other side of the world that is creating its opportunities. And Dow went to work at Goldman Sachs, which is but we knew both when we went to both places that we wanted to move back to Birmingham and start this. And so sort of as quick as we got the opportunity to do that, we did.
Yes. Adding to what Richard said, this is Dow. You know, we really felt like from where we had worked and what we had begun with that we really need to have our own vehicle to execute our mandate of investing in a few high quality businesses with no leverage on the fund perspective. And we also believe in eating our own cooking and aligning our interests with those of shareholders. So we invest all of our own net worth in our own funds, and we don't use outside managers. And we believe that this type of vehicle is the best way to go about doing that and the best way to perform over long periods of time after tax.
And maybe just a brief word about back in 2009, we had one of the genesis of the mutual fund itself. We had one of our investors come to us and say that they wanted a 1940 Act vehicle for some of the assets that they controlled, that they advised on. So we built it more or less to satisfy that one client's need, but knowing that the business was attractive and one that would hopefully draw the same type of investors that we had enjoyed on the private side. And that has been proven to be the case for us. We have a lot of wonderful relationships now as a result of the mutual fund that we didn't have before. But one of the advantages of sort of coming at it that way is that we designed the mutual fund to with the same management fee with very similar structure and as much as possible so that it would mirror what we were already doing and so that we wouldn't have any incentives to favor one over the other. So, and further to that, we invest roughly half our money both on the private side and the public side so that our, we're eating our own cooking.
So moving on to our investment approach, I mean, the core idea is that we are seeking to minimize permanent capital loss and maximize long-term returns by specifically investing in a few select domestic and foreign businesses that meet our core investment criteria, which are circle of competence, business, people, and price. The intersection of those four points are what define a good investment for us.
And I think one of the things that perhaps makes us different from some other value investors is that we spend a lot of time thinking about circle of competence, talking about it here internally. And I think there are several aspects of our relationship that make that work for us. But perhaps, I know that Mr. Munger talks about this all the time, but with the exception of him, we are probably more focused on the fact that we will make mistakes, but how can we avoid, how can we lower the chances of that so that maybe we'll make less than our fair share. Parts of that are, let's only invest in businesses where we're capable of understanding the long-term economics, and that is going to eliminate a lot of businesses. What are the things that we're looking at that we should put in the too hard pile? We also try to be disciplined about what we know and what we don't know. So one of the advantages of knowing Dow my whole life virtually is that I know the limits of his knowledge. I don't know everything that he knows, but I know when he's talking about something he doesn't know. And that serves as a useful check. I think I call him out. We have a pretty vigorous debate, as you might imagine. But I call him out when I think he's saying something that he doesn't know, and vice versa. We also know each other's tendencies and weaknesses, and I think it makes us less likely to sort of hold hands and go off the cliff together.
We also try to expand that circle of competence. You've heard Mr. Buffett speak a lot, Munger too, about how this business is really a cumulative business. So while we're always looking at the businesses that we think we can currently understand and ones that we don't, we put in the two hard pile, we're looking geographically, we're looking at different lines of business, et cetera, to always expand that circle of competence. And over time, I think that learning and research, et cetera, will expand our investment universe and improve our process and improve our results over time, hopefully.
Yeah, and we're specifically trying to find places and sectors and market capitalizations, et cetera, where we have some competitive advantage. Sometimes that competitive advantage is just that we're patient investors and that we're willing to wait 5 to 10 years and hold something and wait to see how something works out, or we have a better view of that and we're not focused on the short term. But sometimes that's because we've gone to 400 points of sales in Northern Argentina and actually have an informational advantage over what's in the market and what's in analyst reports. And so we want to go and find the weaker competition to compete against. Another piece of circle of competence is sort of thinking about the common errors of psychological misjudgment. I think a very important one is for value investors is commitment bias. The human tendency is strongly to, once you make a decision, to distort subsequent data to confirm the original decision. And this happens over and over again with value investors, where you buy something and then it goes down and everyone else sees that it's a mistake to have bought it because of something's changed technology-wise or what have you. But you can't see it because you distort all the data that comes in to prove your original thesis. So one of the ways that we try to combat that is to think about all the reasons we don't like what we own all the time, which is actually something that I learned from Paul Jones, perhaps, on the other side of the world. But also, we actually try to hypothesize the events that, if they were to occur, would prove our thesis wrong. So whenever you buy something, you have some sort of idea of how you think it's going to work out and why. So what are, imagine beforehand, a priori, what the things are that will prove that wrong, and in hopes that you have a better chance of recognizing them when they do occur because you've thought about them in advance.
Moving on, the next important part of what we do is that we're buying businesses, not pieces of paper. We actively seek companies that have some type of durable competitive advantage, and it's very difficult to predict the future of a business if you can't say what that competitive advantage is going in. You need to be able to define it to figure out why that business might be able to produce excess returns on equity for extended periods of time. One way to do that is to try to really have a deep focus on understanding the customer's decision. Why did they make the initial decision to purchase that good or service? Why do they continue to do so, or what might cause them to make a different decision to purchase a substitute or something else, or how do all the complements, et cetera, affect the nature of that business, and really try to figure out the one or two factors that make that business special. Part of that is that we also prefer conservative balance sheets on companies because, as we learned so painfully in 2008, or as the markets learned painfully in 2008, companies with weak balance sheets in times of crisis find that they have very difficult trouble staying in business, even big, well-known major corporations.
And then, I think maybe something that's evolved for us over time is that we've learned through a few particular cases how important terrific leadership is at a business. And we are looking for people to run the businesses that we own that we want to be in business with. So the same types of things we think about when we're deciding whether or not, when I was deciding whether or not I wanted to be partners with Dow or whether or not I wanted to be partners with David, those are the same types of things we should be thinking about when we're looking at the management of the business. What I want this person, do I trust this person? Are their incentives aligned with mine? Are they buying the stock personally? Do they, do I think they are diluting themselves in some way? Do I think that they're marketing their stock to me, or do you think that they're focused on the long run? Are they focused on delighting customers or solving customers' problems in some way? Or are they focused on, doing something fancy on their balance sheet to make short-term performance a little bit better?
There's several important indicators that I think are useful for both retail and institutional investors when evaluating management. One of the primary ones is conservative and easily understandable accounting. Too many businesses have things going on their balance sheets or in their income statements or whatever that just don't make sense for what should be a a simple or an easy to understand situation. And if you can't get an answer from the CFO or the investor relations department in a hurry, that makes sense. Those are the types of companies you should tend to avoid. Accounting rules and GAAP are not perfect, but they also leave a lot of room for manipulation, all types of other things too. And so good management tends to have simple accounting for simple things. The other way is to closely evaluate what management says versus what they do. Frequently, that's best, I guess, garnered from a lot of times their written communications. You know, we like to read letters from managements where they talk about their mistakes first and go into what they're going to do to fix their mistakes. And then when you read the annual report or whatever from the next year, they go back and address the concerns that they had before, what progress has been made, et cetera, as opposed to sweeping it under the rug or focusing on metrics that make no sense for the business, et cetera. And the other thing that's really important for evaluating management is frequently a manager ascends to the top by being a great operator of the business. But there's an additional skill once you get to the top of the business. It might be 50 or 60 or 70% of what you do, and that's allocating the capital that the business generates, the excess cash. So you have three uses for that. You can pay dividends, you can buy back stock, or you can reinvest the cash. And we don't care which a company does, but it's usually pretty obvious what they should be doing with that money. So if it's a high return on equity business where they can put that cash to work, they should be putting the cash back into expansion. Stock buyback should only be done when shares are trading below what the intrinsic value of the business is. If they're buying stock back just to soak up options dilution, et cetera, then they're destroying value for the shareholder. And, of course, dividends make sense in the right environment as well. We don't care which the company does. We just want management that does the right thing for shareholders.
Yeah, and then obviously we've learned from Ben Graham. I mean, that's where we come from. So price is imperative. And the way any investment can be, no matter how good or bad the business or whatever, can be a bad investment if the price is too high. And it can be a good investment if the price is low enough. And we buy some horrible businesses for $1. That you always have to come back and value the business. So the way we think about that is, you know, something close to net income, but what owner earnings, you know, what is the cash that this business would throw off to me if I was the only owner? And then I think about how far can the future, can we predict that reliably? And I think that's maybe where we see the world differently from many of the analyst reports and so forth that we see. We think most businesses are difficult to predict into the distant future. But if you're paying 15 times earnings for something, you are implicitly saying that you know something about how much money they're going to make in 12 years. And I think that's very difficult to say for a lot of businesses because they're levered, because technology could change, because competitive forces could change, because government action could change, et cetera, et cetera. And or bad management can come along between here and there and so forth. So the best way to be able to put a multiple like that on a business is to for them to have some sort of durable moat that really allows you to see the future. And if they don't, then we're going to have a hard time paying those types of valuations for them. When we value a business, we are looking for to pay a substantial discount to that, so that we have, you know, a margin of safety between what we're paying and the true value. So hopefully, when we make a mistake, we'll break even.
And moving on to our research process and portfolio construction, you know, for a firm like ours, it tends to hold between 7 and 12 or 15 securities, depending on the opportunity set available at any given time. You know, we go out and do fundamental bottom-up research ourselves. Sometimes that's getting in planes and going to places and visiting hundreds or thousands of stores. Sometimes that's doing a lot of reading and research and coming through company filings, et cetera. But that's the beginning of the process, this fundamental, I guess, belief that we need to go through all the primary sources ourselves and see that everything is as presented, et cetera.
And, one other idea, I think, you've already mentioned the fact that we're pretty concentrated, but, you know, we want to attract investors that see the world the way we do, and because that is important for our mutual success. And, you know, one of those aspects is the way we think about risk. We think that volatility provides us opportunities. We would rather the world be more volatile. Not the world necessarily, but stock prices be more volatile. Because if we own a business and someone comes and is willing to pay us too much for it, or is willing to sell us their share at a big discount, that provides additional opportunities for us to make money besides just the underlying growth of the business or change in the value of the business, of the underlying business. So we see that as opportunity, not as risk. Where we see risk is, what are the chances that a business significantly underperforms our expectations? That is, that either something happens that causes the business, some outside event happens that causes the business to underperform, or perhaps self-inflicted, or that we made a mistake in our analysis because we fooled ourselves in some way. We thought we understood something that we didn't. That is really where you, in our view, where you permanently lose capital, and we're very happy for stock quotations to trade anywhere.
Yeah, so in order to be concentrated, there are two specific things that matter a great deal. One is that the portfolio itself have no leverage. I mean, underlying portfolio companies can have small amounts of leverage, of course, but if the portfolio has no leverage, then that tends to protect us if we're wrong in the evaluation of a business, that the whole portfolio can't blow up because of one bad thing. And the other thing is sizing positions accordingly. And, you know, just a simplified version of that is that, you know, the more, obviously the higher the expected return, the higher a position size you can make, but also the larger the range of outcomes and the higher the probability that a business could have a negative outcome, the smaller a position should be. And that's something I think a lot of other value investors don't focus as much on because it's not quite as quantifiable. It's more of a feel issue.
Right.
And knowing when to not make the position too big just because of the high expected return is matters.
Great. I thought we'd take a few minutes to raise some questions that my readers had and then see if the folks who are listening in on the call had questions of their own. And I thought the place that I would start were the two distinctions that you have in your portfolio. One is that it probably holds fewer stocks than any other equity fund. And the other is that you have a pretty substantial slug of cash right now, about a third of the portfolio. You talked about your approach when looking at a company, that if a company has a lot of cash, they should do one of two things. One of them is put it to work, and the other is give it back to the people. And I was kind of wondering how you think about your own sort of cash reserves. I mean, it's a large position. Is it permanently so?
No, the way we sort of think about it, David, is how would we want all of our own money invested right now given the opportunity set? Because all of our investable net worth is invested in the funds. So when there are lots of opportunities, like March of 2009, we had 2% cash or some very small amount of cash. And at other times, we've had 50%, not in the life of the mutual fund. I think this is the most cash we've ever had in the mutual fund. But nevertheless, we've had 50% or more in cash for a brief period of time. I think on average over our 11 plus years, it's been around 25% cash, I think.
Mm-hmm.
But it's certainly gone up and down significantly. And we don't really take a macro view to decide what that should be. But if we aren't finding individual opportunities, we will do nothing. And I think that over the course of a cycle or over the course of a 15, 20-year period of time, you have to be willing to look stupid in order to have the best outcome. And clearly we've been in a since March of 2009, we've been in a big bull market. But our expectation would be if markets continue to rise like they have over the next year, that we will underperform the market. I mean, it'd be very difficult for us not to, given the amount of cash we have.
Yeah, and cash is, as Richard mentioned, it's the residual. It is not the macro decision. When we find things to buy, we put the cash to work, and when we don't find things to buy, we believe in being patient because we subscribe to the, rule number one is don't lose money, and rule number two is don't forget rule one. The quickest way to ruin your investment performance over time is to suffer a permanent loss of capital.
Mm-hmm. And so you've said, when compelling opportunities don't exist, it's your obligation not to put capital at risk. So how should folks think about that? Is it your general sense that there aren't really many compelling opportunities in equities worldwide right now, or?
Well, it very well may be that other people are smarter than us, and that they understand something better than we do, and that they're going to make a lot of money. And I guess we've never been motivated by sort of envy that someone else is doing something smarter than we are.
Uh-huh.
But we do try to be disciplined about what we know and what we can do. And we are searching hard. I mean, we have literally hundreds of names on our watch list that we're prepared to invest in very rapidly, you know, all over the world. I spent a good bit of time today on several names that we'd like to own, but that currently aren't at prices that we think are compelling. So we try to spend times like this getting prepared, trying to uncover a new company or a new situation that we didn't understand or what have you, try to be prepared when things are compelling. But you know, right now, certainly, I mean, by our cash levels, we're implicitly saying that we're having a hard time finding a lot of compelling things to do.
So we work on expanding our circle of competence.
The time preference for money has not gone away, and people.
Sorry, try that again. The time preference
for money hasn't changed. People still would rather consume now as opposed to later.
Okay.
And so ultimately, investors are going to demand a positive real return on their money.
Uh-huh.
But you have, you know, basically all of the debt markets in the world are earning a negative real interest rate. That's not sustainable. And certainly a lot of people argue that equity prices are cheap relative to debt markets, and that certainly is true. But I guess there are not very many things. You know, it is in a world where people are comparing opportunity costs, and we tend to not want to do things unless we think we can make 10-12% of our money. And maybe we will. It is true that that's in a 2% treasury world, that that's a fanciful idea, and that we will seem silly for demanding that, and we should be happy making 5 or 6% in a number of things, which there are a number of ways you can make 5 or 6%, we think, safely. But I guess we would prefer to wait on some dislocation somewhere, whether that's a particular asset class or capitalization side or geography or industry or what have you. Our feeling is that in general, the cash that we have, which is such a call option of the world, will be a good investment for us when that time happens, and we're able to deploy it hopefully rapidly.
Yeah, we just need one dislocation or two. I mean, it doesn't take much to move our needle in the portfolio because we are concentrated.
Right, and so panic in one area might be enough to generate a significant drawdown on your cash.
Yeah, but we could get rid of our cash in a couple weeks if the right environment or the right couple opportunities, you know, arose. So,
okay.
And we have done that in the past, and our cash levels have risen fairly quickly at times. So we will, it's sort of extreme patience combined with extreme decisiveness around here. Anyway, if we're doing it right, hopefully we are preparing all the time to be able to do the right thing when opportunity arises.
Well, and the preparation itself is just fascinating to me, guys. I talked with David Hobbs before about the notion that you might spend the equivalent of, you know, months in the field, you know, visiting all of the convenience stores in Poland or wandering around in shops in northern Argentina, trying to understand, I guess, competitors and customer behavior. Is that kind of typical of the approach you've had to take?
Yeah, I think that I think that one of the things that we think about is that the great businesses most good moats in business, and there's some exceptions, but most good moats are somewhere wrapped around the idea that a business in a unique way can delight their customers. And you know, and so what we're, the part that is sometimes harder to find in financials is what is the customer's decision? Why are they making the decision that they're making? And are they likely to repeat it? And are they likely to repeat it over time? And are they likely to repeat it if the price of substitutes change? And are they likely to repeat it if complements change and so forth? And so in order to do that, of course, that understanding that is different for different businesses. It's different for, but, you know, I think an area where we've had some success is understanding those decisions in emerging markets. And we have found that a lot of investors that are covering these companies will fly to a conference at Capital City, go to a two-day conference at a fancy hotel, and then fly back to New York, and they, quote, understand that country. And we certainly don't know, I mean, there are certainly people know more about things than we do, but we have definitely found it additive to our process to go do visits on the ground. I guess maybe an example of an investment we've made was in Dallas or Spanish speaker. But
Parque Continental.
Well, the Embotelladoras.
Embotelladoras Arca originally.
Before they bought Continental, but which is a terrific business, one of the finest businesses in the world, and run by one of the best management teams we've ever dealt with. But they are, well, when we found them, they were a Coke bottler in northern Mexico. And we were on like our sixth or seventh trip to Mexico at the time, and we were very intrigued with how good the Coca-Cola business was in Mexico. And we were trying to figure out a way to participate in it that was not too expensive. And because Coca-Cola FEMSA, which was the obvious way to participate, was fairly expensive. And so we looked at both Arca and Cantal, which were two separate public companies at the time, and we just said, well, let's get in the car in Birmingham. And we drove down the east coast of Mexico to Tampico and into the center of the country to Aguascalientes, up to Zacatecas, and then up to Monterrey. And by doing that, we wanted to go through, we already spent a good bit of time in Mexico City, but we wanted to go through four different bottlers' territories to try to examine their relative execution at the point of sale to try to figure out if what we'd seen in the stores in Monterrey and Mexico City existed elsewhere out in the countryside where, and Coke, you know, if you go there, you'll find that the brand equity of Coke relative to Pepsi is much higher than it is in the United States, where a lot of people will sort of switch.
I mean, Coke in northern Mexico outsells Pepsi on a scale of something like 2-1, and Coke's actually able to outprice Pepsi. They can sell at a premium of 15-20% on a store shelf, even in a major city. And when you get out to a small village or town, you won't even find a Pepsi in a store because they're just not big enough to have the distribution network to profitably get their product out. So this particular business has an unusual moat in that the original Arca company had something like 192,000 points of sale. And being able to
at $7,000 per point of sale or so, $7,100 per point of sale.
And being able to get the trucks and the inventory properly at those points of sale is a tremendous competitive advantage in what's otherwise a manufacturing and distribution business, which in the U.S. tends to be a relatively low margin one, but down in Mexico it happens to be a huge margin one.
So in addition to sort of the moat surrounding brand, which you have, and you also have a moat surrounding distribution, and I think that accrues to the dominant brewer in each area of Mexico, and then Coca-Cola, and then Bimbo, which is a bread and confectionery maker. But I don't know how else to try to understand that moat and that without going there. And that,
right.
In fact, we wouldn't have even known about the business if we hadn't been to Mexico before. And so that's what we do. And then they bought a Coke bottler in northern Argentina, two Coke bottlers actually. And so we went down there and spent 3 weeks in going to four different bottlers in Argentina's territories, in addition to two different bottlers in Chile to try to understand their relative execution.
But I don't want to leave your listeners with the impression that we are on the road 6 months of a year in all these places. I mean, certainly we are born and raised in the United States and understand the U.S., and I think we've gotten to a pretty good understanding of Mexico and the LATAM area as well. So, you know, we're spending a lot of time researching all types of businesses, but certain businesses do require us to get in a plane and or get in a car and go far afield, but that's not necessarily true for every company we own.
Okay. Thanks, Al. And what I'd like to do is ask one follow-up to that, but before I do, you know, we're kind of creeping up on the point where we would generally ask folks who have been listening that if they had questions they'd be free to ask them. And so I thought I would take a second and ask Emily if she would explain to folks how they could let her know that they have a question they would like to ask, and then I'll go back to my follow-up.
To ask a question, you may press star, then 1 on your touch-tone phone. If you're using a speakerphone, we do ask that you pick up your handset before pressing the keys. And to draw your question, you can press star, then 2. But again, it's star, then 1 to ask a question.
And you'll have a chance to do that in just a couple, 3 minutes. So if you want to, press star 1 now to get Emily's attention. I've been speaking with a very distinguished retired fund manager who's read a lot about your fund, and the question he had was about what's called the signal-to-noise ratio. His concern, I think, was that if you go in the field and if you spend 3 weeks, you know, driving around small-town Mexico, the amount of time and energy you've committed is so great that it's hard not to convince yourself that you found something there that's kind of actionable. And I didn't know if there are many times when you do these sort of extended trips and you just end up thinking, nope, not worthwhile, or where you've made a decision that you've later regretted, or have you been able, in your protect ourselves against being stupid mode, have you been able to stop yourself from jumping too quickly?
Well, yeah, I mean, I think that sort of we kind of think about that all the time. Actually, is sort of, we call it deal momentum. Just like once you invest a lot of time in an idea, it's hard to get away from it. And so that is one of the things we sort of actively think about avoiding. And last summer Dal and I spent 3 weeks in Eastern and Central Europe, going from Estonia through Poland to Hungary, and we bought nothing. We did learn a lot about several businesses that we were interested in, including Tesco, which we own. But we were hoping to find a couple things to do, but we didn't. I went back later in the summer and spent 2 weeks in Greece and a week in Turkey, and we didn't buy anything either. We did add some things to the list of things we'd like to own, but we haven't found anything and we eliminated some things that we thought we previously might be able to understand. But we didn't buy anything. In fact, when I was in Greece, one of the things that happened, anyway, that's why I think the advantage of going and spending an extended period of time as opposed to a couple of days and meetings is the management of the companies are usually pretty good at selling you on their company. So you want to benefit from that if they're offering it. I mean, it's certainly not without merit, but we also try to meet with other wealthy people in the country that might have a view about the country that would be helpful, and ask management about other businesses in their country outside of their industry where they don't have the same sort of bias. But then also we want to accidentally have conversations with other people. That's just part of our process. So I was at a cafe and the guy there said, in a small little town called Mistra, and the guy there said, well, are you from the United States? And I said, yes. He said, where are you from? I said, Alabama. And he said, well, my friend over here is from Alabama too. And I went wind up being introduced, and we had a four-hour dinner with a man who lives in Birmingham and has lived here for 20 years but originally was from this small town. Mm-hmm. He was back spending a month that summer. And so I wind up having a conversation with his childhood friends for 4 hours, some of it being translated, and about what's really going on in Greece. And what I learned more from that conversation than anything else I did in Greece was that they all, they believed that the Germans owed them the money because they were slow to pay their war reparations, and that they didn't think that they should have to pay their taxes because no one else did, and that the system of sort of bribing the tax collector when he shows up, which is, I guess, the same thing as Matthew and Zacchaeus from 2,000 years before, hasn't really, the system is broken fundamentally, and there's really not much interest in changing it. And so I came away, I went in part to learn what a country looked like when it was falling apart firsthand, and as much as any of the other companies, as much as some of the specific companies we were looking at, but also I went more optimistic that because there were so much blood in the streets and the headlines were so bad, that there might be an opportunity, and I didn't find that. I found that, you know, there were several businesses that we couldn't understand. There were several that we could, but they didn't. The prices were not yet attractive, and so we frequently do trips and don't buy anything.
And there's also, again, to reiterate, a benefit of us having known each other for so long, where I don't have any problem telling Richard, no, I don't think that you understand this, or I don't understand this. Please explain it to me. Please explain it to me. Please explain it to me.
Great. Emily, did we have questions?
Yes. The first question comes from Alan Booth. Please go ahead.
Before I ask you a question, I really wanted to commend you on the reading list that you have on your website. You can learn a lot about an investment philosophy by what the managers read, and your reading list is quite impressive. Now I'd like to ask you my question. Since you have been public after the market crash, and since your investment philosophy is similar to how you've been managing your private portfolios, how did the private portfolios do compared to the market indices during the downturn?
Well, I think we have. I want to be careful because I think there's some potential regulatory issues with us disclosing those private returns precisely, but we certainly can do that offline. But we sort of think about the 08-09 period in aggregate, and we outperformed the market pretty substantially over the combined 08-09 period. And so I don't know that we should be more specific, and it'd be construed that we're trying to use those returns to sell the mutual fund, which I think can get us in trouble. But yeah, is that helpful?
Maybe let me phrase it a little bit differently. Is your expectation that in the down markets you're going to be down less than the S&P 500, and in an up market you're going to be basically parallel to that or a little bit not quite as good with less volatility?
That has certainly been the case for people that have used our style over time, and that is roughly been the case for us in our 11 years of history, but I certainly can't guarantee that. But we certainly would hope that we will, by owning higher quality businesses with less leverage and by buying them at reasonable prices, that we will not go down quite as much in a serious bear market such as 08, a panic. And we also hope that we will be able to, if we have cash in particular, but even not, if we were able to recognize the opportunities when they exist in those moments and get very aggressive, that will allow us to really make the sort of the outperformance that allows you to have good returns over 5 or 10 year periods of time.
I think we can say one thing that we did do was, based on opportunity cost analysis, sell certain positions that had either not gone down or not gone down much and trade into positions that had gotten dramatically cheaper just on a valuation basis, which is something that our philosophy allows. And to partially reiterate one of Richard's points, yes, it's unlikely that we will match the market stride for stride if we've got 40% cash and it's making a new high every day, because we're unlikely to own the types of securities that are causing the market to do that. But we don't worry about anything day to day, week to week, year to year, really.
Yeah, maybe just another little window into that period of time and how we were thinking about it. And for Christmas in 2008, I convinced my wife, she's a trooper, that we would not give each other Christmas presents. Because we'd not go to dinner, we wouldn't get babysitters. I mean, all the different ways, basically any way that we could at the margin save money and put it into the stock market, that was how compelling we thought that window of opportunity was from December 08 through probably the end of March of 09, that we thought it was an extraordinary opportunity to buy stocks in a sort of a once every 20 year period. And we did that in our personal lives, and we did that with, just in terms of the way we saved our money, and then we also did it with the way we bought stocks in the fund.
Cool.
Fine,
Emily, is there another question online?
Yes. The next question comes from Andrea Linde. Please go ahead.
My question is whether your fund will be or is available at any major brokerages with NTF platform so that we would not pay for buying it.
That might be a question for David.
Yeah, I mean, I can address that briefly. We've on the distribution side, we've found success getting into platforms that individuals are interested in or invest individually, or that registered independent advisor firms invest. We have not had much luck with the wirehouses, primarily because we don't have a there's several reasons. One is our size and our relative newness. Another is the fact we don't have a load and we don't have a 12b1 fee. We think we just philosophically don't think those are the right features for a mutual fund. And so so I would anticipate that we're going to continue to have trouble on the wirehouse platforms. We do have direct accounts that are custodied with U.S. Bank, who is the administrator for the mutual fund, that are free. That are if you're willing to establish an account there, that you can do that and buy it without any fees on the front end. You know, right. Just some maintenance fees overall. But
we're also available on a number of the discount brokerage platforms: Schwab, Fidelity,
yeah.
Ameritrade,
and we have a list of those on our website.
But as you mentioned, there is a commission associated with that, and that's because we don't have a 12b1 fee program, and we're not willing to have a load to compensate the firms for carrying our fund.
But that's imposed by Schwab or what yeah. have you. But if you go to cookandbynum.com and click through to the mutual fund sign up there, you can invest directly without any fee.
Yeah, essentially, the question is that such funds like Oakmark, for example, they also don't have 12b1 payments, but you can buy them on Fidelity, for example, and your fund will need to pay $75 for buying.
Yeah, and that's a little bit of a function of their size.
I think what he's actually getting at is the one source platforms that we're. I'm sorry. I think we misunderstood the question. There. Fidelity and Schwab, Schwab is sort of on the RIA side, they're sort of 60% of the business, and Fidelity is another 15% or something. But they try to use the power of that position to cram fees onto managers. So I think to be on the one Schwab one source platform is 40 basis points. So the funds, and that can be negotiated. If you're a very large fund that Schwab can not afford to not carry, sometimes you can negotiate that down. But for a small fund like ours, we've sort of made the business decision that most of the people that are interested in us will come and find us, and as opposed to our paying 40 basis points of the to Schwab for the privilege. Does that make sense?
Yes.
Great. Emily, are there other questions, ma'am?
Oh, once again, if you'd like to ask a question, please press star and then one.
And while we wait for folks to move in that direction, you had mentioned, this is just a freakish note, the Greeks are annoyed at slow war reparations.
So
the reparations were due from the First World War?
No, from World War II, I think. They believe that... they believe two things. One, they believe because of the current account surplus that Germany has been running, selling cars and washing machines to the rest of Europe at a sort of, you could argue, a relatively artificially low euro exchange rate or Deutschmark to Drachmark exchange rate. They believe that the Germans have been taking advantage of them. They've been benefiting at the Greeks' expense for the way, you know, with this currency. So they resist the Germans for that reason. And this is not all Greeks. Of course, a lot of Greeks understand what's really happening, but this is definitely a strongly accepted view from a subset of the German people. I mean, of the Greek people. And they also believe that the Germans did not pay their war reparations from World War II, or didn't pay them. I don't know exactly the details, but that they didn't pay them. I'm sure that the person accusing the Germans of this didn't know it also, but that they didn't feel obligated to. Pay the Germans back for all the bailouts that the Germans were doing, because they feel like Germany owed them, and which is just a reminder of, we always call ourselves the dumb Americans, but it's always a healthy reminder that other parts of the world are far more complex than you normally would think about them from an American perspective, and that there's a long history of people and the French don't like the Germans, and the Scots don't like the English, and the English don't like the French, and There's hundreds of years of this, and of course, they in general they're getting along and doing business and so forth. But it's nevertheless that some of those underlying forces are at play. And I thought that it was a really good article. I think we put it in our CNB notes, which we've sent out, or it's on our blog maybe. But the there was a really good article in The Economist about where they sort of traced this Euro experiment as no different from Charlemagne. And they traced the Holy Roman Empire and all the various ways that Northern Europe has tried to unite into a central economic power or political power over since 800. I guess Charlemagne's about 800. Mm-hmm. I could be wrong on that, my dates. But which I just thought was an interesting perspective to sort of pull back and you know, I always find it helpful to pull back, and I was thinking about that when I was touring, you know, some of the Greek ruins also, but pull back and think about how things are very much the same as they've always been.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's a very healthy, it's very helpful as an investor to think about those things, that, that this time it's really not different, and you know, history rhymes.
And as Americans, it particularly behooves us to go do this, because the things you read in the U.S. press don't really touch on these things. And even if you get a hold of some of the better foreign press in English, like The Economist or The FT or whatever, their in-depth articles, you still can't really get a feel for those types of things unless you go to these places and see what's happening firsthand, see whether the system is really dysfunctional or whether it's, you know, dramatically improving like it has been in Mexico or Chile, as a counterexample to the Greek situation, but especially over there, the histories are hundreds of thousands of years long, and they can't be explained by recent events necessarily.
Sure, they're reflected but not explained, really. Emily, were there questions?
Yes, we've had a couple more come in, so the next question is from Jeff Bush. Please go ahead.
Hi, guys. Thanks for taking my call. I'd be curious to know what you had to buy your wife's after 2008 for Christmas. But I was wondering, touching back on Greece, you know, certainly one would think that there would be a lot of what Ben Graham and David Dodd called net-net opportunities available in the country over the last couple of years. And were you guys, you know, not interested? And certainly it seems from your style overall that's not something that you would pursue, but was that given any consideration, or are you still sticking to that same philosophy?
We looked at two or three businesses that we thought were very good. And I'll tell, one of them in particular did a majority of their, well, did a 95% of their business outside of Greece. And we were hoping we'd get an opportunity to buy it, but I don't think that's going to occur now. We looked at several businesses that we thought were pretty decent businesses, but we didn't think they were quite cheap enough. And then we looked at a lot of really lousy businesses or ones that we thought, you know, some of this is that we are the dumb American, and you got to be careful when you're the dumb American about things that you don't understand. But I'm sure that those opportunities existed, but I'm not sure that we were always in the, we were always best equipped to deal with those as the dumb American. And a couple things that I've that, seemed interesting. I just couldn't quite figure out what the government risk was, because they're in two cases they were making most of their money basically because of the what the government was doing, and that seemed possible. It certainly seemed possible to me that that would change, and might possibly rapidly, and given the political situation there. And I was concerned about, you know, how do you pay 5x earnings or something when you're not sure that, you know, the economy is going to continue to contract. So that's really a declining earnings stream, and then you're not sure if the way that their money is going to, way they're making their money is going to persist if the government changes their mind about how they want to treat them.
And to add to that, philosophically, we're not opposed to that type of value investing. We consider it really a continuum where you go from the Ben Graham system of owning 100 or 200 lousy businesses because you know a bunch of them are not going to work out in your favor, be they net nets or similar such businesses, to more of the Mr. Munger 1973-74 period where he owned just three companies in his portfolio. And we certainly tend towards the Munger side of that spectrum, because good businesses tend to earn outsized returns on profits. They can reinvest the money perhaps at higher rates of return than we can over time, and they tend to have good problems. And when you get into another country where like Greece, where we don't have a glorious grasp of their legal system, trying to work with something like a net is a tough thing, and it would have to be a very small position, which is, I think, very wise of the way Graham ran his business.
Great. Emily, you mentioned you had one other question queued up.
Yes, the next question comes from David Hubbard. Please go ahead.
Yeah, hi, gentlemen. Yeah, great discussion. Thanks so much. I just had a couple of quick questions. It was very impressive, and you definitely sound like people I want to invest with. And I maybe a couple of things you could comment on. I'm a long-term guy. I mean, I'm in my 50s, but I'm real healthy, and I plan to be around for many more years and all that sort of thing. It sounds like you guys have very much the same philosophy. It sounds also like you're not going to be the type of people who 2 years from now are going to be moving to the Hamptons becoming hedge fund managers. But do you want to kind of comment on that?
Well, certainly thank you for your comments. I appreciate that. I'm glad we at least have you fooled. But one could call the private partnerships we have hedge funds, even though we don't charge an incentive fee and we don't use leverage and we don't short. So I certainly don't want to cast dispersions on the hedge fund industry, but we are pretty
in structure only.
We're only in structure only, or do we have that sort of structure. But Dow and I think we have the best job in the world. We get paid to learn and read about interesting things and try to predict the world a little bit better than average. And we were doing this for free in high school, and we left jobs where we were making more money.
Closer to the Hamptons,
to move back to Alabama to do this because we had a passion about doing it this way. And so I think it is safe to say that we're going to be doing this for quite a while. We are passionate about this.
Yeah, I would completely agree. We gave up lucrative positions to come back and manage money the way we thought was beneficial. And you know, the three of us in this room own the business completely. There's nobody on the outside that has a stake that can force us to do it differently, and we love it and want to continue doing it.
No, that's great. Oh, sorry.
Sure, you had
go ahead. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
No, saying that's great, and you know, might have sent a little bit almost like a softball, but you know, but these are important things to comment on. So thank you very much.
Sure.
Thank you.
Great. The final question, Emily, or are we set?
We do have one follow-up from Andrea Linde. Please go ahead.
Yeah, actually, it's a question which was asked by Paul in Mutual Fund Observer. The question is, your fund is relatively small, and some people use this smallness for buying, starting from relatively small stocks, because large funds cannot be nimble enough. And meanwhile, your fund does not have neither small nor even mid-cap stocks. You mostly concentrate on the huge, giant stocks. So I wonder whether this is by design or just you have this feeling that all other type of stocks right now are overvalued.
Yeah, it's a good question, and I appreciate the opportunity to talk about this, actually. We do not have a bias towards large stocks or small stocks or domestic stocks or foreign stocks or emerging market stocks or what have you. We try to do what we think, you know, we try to do a few things that we think are intelligent. Early in our business, we owned a lot of small caps. And then somewhere along at about 2004, we found that there was so much money sloshing around in private equity that a lot of the things that we were looking at had a big premium on them because they were going to get bought out in an LBO. And so then we started looking, we did a number of emerging markets things for, you know, a long period there. And then in the last, 24 months that our direct emerging markets exposure has fallen a pretty good bit. And that's really just a result of prices. The prices in emerging markets have got very popular for everyone to own BRICS and everyone to own emerging markets. And, you know, we have this test sort of that if my mother's friends are talking about it, then that's probably not what we should own. And so we moved away from that basically because the prices appreciated so much, and we didn't think we still had a margin of safety.
But it's purely a macro decision on each individual stock.
I mean, a micro decision.
A micro decision on each individual stock. And you know, another factor that influences that is, of course, interest rates. And you see that from, I mean, I have no opinion as to the merits of the deal, but like the Dell deal that happened recently, so multi-billion dollar companies can get bought out with interest rates like this and motivated parties. And so that takes a whole lot of small opportunities off the table, at least in the short run for us. But the world won't be that way always, and we'll own small stocks again. We just don't know when.
Yeah, so there will certainly be a time where we look like a small cap portfolio, and there will be a time where we look like a, you know, foreign portfolio or what have you. And it won't be because we set out to do it that way. It will be because that's where we're finding things to do that we think make sense.
Great. Great. That helps a great deal, guys. And we've kind of reached the top of the hour, and I try to not impose too much on our listeners beyond that. So I wanted to take a moment to thank the crew from Cook & Bynum, thank the Davids in the studio, the Davids on the line, the Davids on the road in New York, and to all of you who are listening for your time tonight. A tape of this call and an audio profile of Cook & Bynum will be available at The Observer on April 1st when we post our next issue. We plan to continue our conversations with managers who are seriously committed to adding value. We hope in the next couple months to speak with David Rolfe at River Park Wedgwood and Steve Dodson at the Breton Fund. We would be honored by your company at each of those calls, and we were most especially honored by the willingness for Dow, Richard, David, and company to spend part of their evening with us tonight. And so thank you all, friends.
Thank you, David.
Thank you. The conference is now concluded. Thank you for attending today's presentation. You may now disconnect.